session. So Josh, let me make sure that everyone can see you on the screen today, and I'll go ahead and turn it over to you to provide opening remarks.
Thank you very much, Jean. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Josh Williard, and I'll be your moderator today. For those of you guys who attended our morning or our earlier session today, welcome back. For those of you just joining us for the first time, welcome. I'd like to take this moment to talk a little bit about the EPA-SAME partnership that we have. Our objective is to create an open space for informational exchange between the public and private sectors on common design and construction issues encountered at hazardous waste sites. These webinars and the biannual symposiums offer a forum for practitioners to talk about their experiences, lessons learned, and techniques in design and construction issues. And they also offer opportunities to enhance communication networks and promote dialogue amongst professionals in the industry. And as you can see, we have some events coming up. The East Symposium, March 30th to April 1st in Philadelphia, as well as the West Symposium, and the registration for that just became open recently, and a link will be put in the chat box for everyone to peruse. And also we have ongoing webinar seminar series, including the webinars and in-person trainings. More about the webinars that we have. We had one in January, March, two in May. This is our second one for July, and we have one upcoming in September as well. We also have an EPA SAME construction management training, and feel free to visit www.dchws.org for more info about these and other events that we have. So a little bit more about the upcoming webinar that we have in September. It will be about 10 years of optimization of the environmental restoration program at a DOD facility in North Carolina. That will be on September 15th from 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern. Registration will open soon. Feel free to follow that link when the time comes. And now I would like to introduce the presenters that we have joined with us today. So first is Chapman Ross. He's the Director of Technology for FRX and is based in Boston, Massachusetts. He has over 20 years of environmental industry experience focused on in situ remediation design and innovative technology development. Chapman is a technical expert in injection methods for in situ treatment, specializing in amendment delivery methods for low permeability formations, such as hydraulic fracturing, direct injection, and high pressure jetting. He's led the design and remediation projects utilizing chemical oxidation, for example, permanganate, persulfate, peroxide, and ozone. Chemical reduction with zero valent iron and enhanced bioremediation. Chapman earned a bachelor's degree in civil engineering and a master's degree in environmental engineering and science, both from Clemson University in South Carolina. Chapman is a certified professional engineer in Massachusetts. Also
thanks,
joining
Josh.
Yes.
Hello, everyone. Thanks.
You guys can see their beautiful smiling faces. Also joining us today is Drew Baird. Drew is a professional geologist and has more than 20 years of experience in remediation design and implementation, project and team management, field support services, and environmental consulting. He's currently a senior geologist at FRX, where he leads the company's business development efforts and provides technical support on soil and groundwater remediation projects to clients in the US and Canada. Prior to joining FRX, Drew was the East Region Manager at Regenesis, where he was responsible for managing sales and technical support associated with the company's remediation products in the Eastern US. He spent his first 5 years in the industry with a regional engineering firm in Greenville, South Carolina, and is a registered professional geologist licensed in South Carolina. And he currently resides in Charlotte. Without further ado, I would like to pass the mic on to our presenters for today, Chapman and Drew. Please feel free to take over the screen.
All right, wonderful. Thank you, Josh. Thank you, Jean. And we also want to thank Sammy, both the Philadelphia Post and the Denver Post, for sponsoring today's event. I know that I'm excited to get back in person to the Philly event this spring, as well as to the Denver event in the fall. So, but in the meantime, we happy to have the opportunity here to present to you on hydraulic fracturing for remediation. And specifically, this is geared towards remediation of low permeability sites, which all of us who have been doing assessment and remediation continue to struggle with. They're difficult sites, among the most difficult that are out there. And Chapman and I are going to present on an injection technology or set of technologies that are well suited for delivering large amounts of remedial materials to low permeability settings. And today we're going to focus primarily on case studies involving in situ chemical oxidation and in situ chemical reduction. So with that, I'll get right to the outline here. There we go. And click. There we go. All right. So the first thing we're going to start with are principles and applications of hydraulic fracturing. And there we'll talk about fracture form. We'll talk about very briefly how fractures are created. And we'll talk about, more importantly, how fractures are used, because that's going to form the basis upon which we build the rest of the presentation. After that, we're going to pause and have a Q&A. So I'll have part one of the Q&A, because we do cover quite a bit of material in that first part on principles and applications. So we'll pause there and allow the audience to ask questions, followed by the case studies. And I'm going to begin that section by talking about chemical oxidation using hydraulic fracturing. And there are a couple of different ways by which chemical oxidants and hydraulic fracturing can be leveraged to support remediation in low permeability settings. Chapman is going to focus on the chemical reduction part of the presentation. So he'll be presenting the case studies on that site. We'll then talk about reagent dosing and field productivity, because this technology allows you to apply a larger mass of material to the subsurface in a shorter period of time than is otherwise possible, especially in low permeability settings. So we want to talk about that. Everyone's interested in costs, so we're going to talk about costs for a series of projects normalized to make sense in context. And then we'll have our second Q&A. And as Gene said early on, we encourage questions, we welcome questions. I look forward to seeing how this voting works, because we've not seen that before. And also peppered in here, we're going to have three poll questions. So we encourage you to reply or respond to those poll questions as well. So with that, let's get into the poll questions. And Gene is going to bring up a screen that will allow you to interact and select. But the poll question I'll read is, what types of amendment delivery methods have you used on your projects? And select all that apply.
Okay, so ladies and gentlemen, you should now have a new pop-up on your screen, which will allow you to respond. I'm looking at about 20% of you have responded, and I know that more of you are answering as I speak, so I'll continue to let this poll run. And once I start to see those responses level out, we'll go ahead and close it and talk a little bit about your answers. The previous webinar used this, and we had about 75% of the audience participating, so I'm sure that you all can get to that same participation rate as well. So I see a handful more of you are sending in your answers. All right, I think right now what I'll go ahead and do is close it out and let's talk about those results. So as I pull these results up, you all can see it, and it does look like almost 86% of you indicated conventional injection wells, and almost the same percentage, 81% direct push injection. But then a number of you have also used soil mixing as well as horizontal injection wells, and then a smaller percentage, only about 17% of you used pneumatic fracturing.
Yeah, very interesting results. I guess the surprise here, we're not talking about soil mixing, but that's a big number for soil mixing, which of course is a good technology. But I just focused on fracturing. There's a decent proportion of the audience here who have employed hydraulic and or pneumatic fracturing on projects. So we've got some familiarity here, but again, what we're starting with on this presentation is to talk about principles and applications. And for those of you who are familiar with hydraulic fracturing, or for those of you who are new to it, this section can apply. There we go. So I said we start by talking about fracture form, because that's a really important concept here. And what you're looking at here is a trench from a site in southern Ohio. So this is glacial clay till. And let's see, Chapman, do you have the ability to turn on the laser pointer? I don't see it here in my options. Ah, there it is. Thank you, sir. What you're looking at here is a trench. This is glacial clay till, and you can tell that it's low permeability from the steep vertical sidewalls and the blocky nature of this material here. This is 10 to the minus 7 centimeter per second clay. And another thing to point out here is this white line is a string that serves as a horizontal datum. So what has happened here is that we've used direct push drilling technologies to advance a probe rod into the ground and create sand-filled fractures at about 3 feet BGS. The second one, or middle one, is at about 5 feet BGS, and the deepest one is close to 7 feet BGS. And a few consistent features to point out here. One is the uniformity of their appearance, of their attitude, for one. They're broad, sheet-like structures with a horizontal attitude. And you can tell from this uppermost one that they do have a slight upward dip, or at least this one does and the lowermost one does, whereas the middle one is pretty much dead flat. But these are broad sheet-like structures. Think of them for the purposes of this presentation of having a radius on the order of approximately 15 feet. They also are uniform in their thickness or aperture, and not quite uniform because you see some undulations in the upper and lower surface of the fracture, but they tend to average on about a centimeter in aperture or thickness, and that scale that you see at the underneath the fracture here is a centimeter scale. So they can be a few millimeters, they can be a centimeter and a half, there's kind of a range, but good average is a centimeter. This fracture, and these all three of these, happen to be filled with coarse sand, which you can think of as engineered preferential flow paths. So this is what fractures look like, and I just want you to keep this image in mind, and you'll see other images from sites where we've excavated after injecting and creating fractures. We've done this in over a dozen sites and have learned a lot about fracture form from that. But just keep this image in mind as to what these fractures look like. Now, before we talk about process, the process does not involve simply advancing a geoprobe rod to the target depth, exposing a portion of the formation to the probe rod, and then turning on a pump until the point where the formation just breaks. That is uncontrolled fracturing and results in a lot of daylighting, surfacing, out of target zone placement of material. This sort of uniformity is based on a process, actually a set of processes and a set of controls for making a good fracture with a horizontal attitude. And the first part of the process is to make a slurry by suspending solids in a viscous gel. And what you're gonna see on the screen here is a potassium permanganate slurry that's being mixed, and it should loop, but what you're seeing here is that the thickness or viscosity of this material can be spoken to by this texture, this kind of ropey nature to it. And it's a slurry that contains up to 65 or 70% solids in the slurry. So these are very solids laden, high solids content slurries that can be created using the proper methods. All right, so I'm gonna exit out of that and go to the PowerPoint. Chapman, I'm going to ask you to get me back over to the PowerPoint, please. Thank you, sir. All right, so you make a slurry, and there are a variety of materials, a variety of solids that can be used to make a slurry. I showed you sand-filled fractures that act as engineered preferential pathways, and those are filled with sand. Here's a sand slurry. You already saw a video of the permanganate slurry. Over here, you've got zero-valent iron, which Chapman is going to talk a lot about. So these, by solids laden, I mean heavy solids content to these slurries. Now, what you do with the slurry is you pump it into the formation faster than the formation will accept it. And you can imagine in a low permeability setting, that formation's not going to readily accept that solids laden slurry, nor will many formations, if any. The subsurface is very effective as a filter. But when you have a good thick slurry where the liquids can't be passed through and the solids can't be filtered out, when you pump the slurry in, you're going to result in pressure buildup, and the formation is going to be stressed to the point where the formation fails, which results in a single planar feature. And I have single fracture in bold because that's what happens when you stress a solid. It doesn't matter whether you're talking about clay till, any other kind of formation, including bedrock, or if you have jello. When you stress a solid to its breaking point, the resulting crack is a planar feature. It's not a dendritic pattern of fractures as you see sometimes portrayed. It is a single fracture, and I'll show you some more trench photographs to illustrate that. But it's a sheet-like structure. This occurs in overburden and bedrock. And the process of injecting this solids-laden slurry simultaneously creates and fills the fracture. So it's a single step. The slurry itself is, as it advances and propagates away from the injection point, creates the fracture and fills it. So that's a very rough outline of how this is done. Now I'll get into applications, and I just want to start by showing a map of where FRX has worked over the years. We started as a company in 1994, and we've worked all over the U.S., up into Canada, and internationally, most recently in Denmark, where we've done two high-profile and sites where we've developed new technologies and new approaches. So those have been instructive. So we've worked at a lot of different types of sites, and our clients hire us to use fractures in really three different ways and three different sort of conceptual approaches. The first is for flow enhancement. And as you can imagine there, what I'm referring to are sand-filled fractures that, again, act as engineered preferential flow paths for either the injection of fluids or the extraction of fluids. So we refer to that as flow enhancement. Going counterclockwise here, the purple disc is chemical diffusion. And if you imagine on the left, that's a stack of fractures. And let's just say for the sake of the presentation, they're about 5 feet apart from one another. Remember, they've got a radius on the order of about 15 feet. And for chemical diffusion, instead of sand being the propant, the solid material that's injected to create the fracture is a chemical oxidant. So I'm going to be talking about that during the chemical oxidation case study portion. And there we go. And then for refractive capture, what I'm referring to is actually something Chapman's going to talk about, and typically involves the application of zero-valent iron. So instead of these being filled with sand or chemical oxidant, these fractures would be filled with zero-valent iron. And Chapman's going to walk through that refractive capture concept. For flow enhancement, I just want to illustrate, before I get to a case study later in the presentation that also highlights flow enhancement, I want to illustrate the concept from a DOD facility in the Midwestern US. And what I've got here on the screen is just a diagram of a conventional injection well. And if it's 2 inches in diameter inside of an 8-inch borehole and has a 10-foot screen with 12 feet of filter pack, you've got a cylinder. The outside of that cylinder is the window into the formation. And the area of that window in a conventional well with the specifications I listed is about 25 square feet. And our client had attempted to use conventional wells at this site. The target geology is low permeability alluvium. And over an 8-month period, they were only able to inject about 280 gallons of an emulsified vegetable oil solution per well, which works out to less than 8 gallons per week for each well. That's not enough to get distribution. That's not enough to affect geochemical change and that are required for the enhanced reductive dechlorination processes to be effective. So we were called to the site to create a series of vertically stacked sand-filled fractures attached to subsequently built injection wells. And the reason why flow enhancement works is essentially because you're creating a much larger window into the formation. And what I'm showing here is a fracture with a radius of 15 feet. And in plan view, I have to assume it's a circle. They're not perfect circles, but pi r squared on 15 feet is 700 square feet of area for each of the bounding surfaces of these fractures. And there's two of them. There's an upper bounding surface and a lower. So together, it's about 1,400 square feet of surface area or window, if you will, into the formation. So we created wells after creating fractures. Our client came back and injected the EVO solution. And in a 2-week period, injected almost 560 gallons or about, you know, over 280 gallons per week for each well, which represents a 37x increase in injection yield. And what we see on sites is that fracture-enhanced wells have a yield, and you can measure that a number of different ways, but they have a yield that is typically 10x to up to 50x greater than a conventional well. So that's why flow enhancement works. You've got a bigger window into the formation, more surface area. Next treatment concept is chemical diffusion, and we love showing permanganate sites or samples from permanganate sites because permanganate is that lovely royal purple color, and what you're seeing here, again, is low permeability alluvium in Wyoming. Thank you, Chapman. And a permanganate-filled fracture here in a CPT core. So here's the fracture, and the CPT core was collected about a week after the injection, and you can already see the diffusion halo that is forming above and below this fracture. And these fracture halos can advance at a rate of 1 to 2 feet per year above and below the fracture. So chemical diffusion is a very effective way to get penetrative distribution of oxidant from a fracture. Increasingly, we're using potassium persulfate in these applications. And there's an example of a potassium persulfate filled fracture in coastal deposits, low permeability coastal deposits. And it doesn't, quote, play as well as permanganate in that persulfate is colorless. So you don't see this diffusion halo, but there's most certainly a diffusion halo that is advancing above and below the fracture. And we'll talk more about persulfate a little bit later on. So for the third treatment concept of refractive capture, I'm gonna hand things over to my colleague Chapman Ross and let him describe that.
Thanks, Drew. So we talked about a couple of different methods. We're gonna get back to diffusion here in a second, but let's talk about refractive capture. And these are the next two mechanisms that I'm going to talk about are really the ones that are kind of keyed into the process of treatment using ZVI. So it's no coincidence that I'm talking about these and I'm going to be talking to you about the ZVI case study in a little while later in the presentation. So refractive capture, you can imagine that you have a block of clay here, which is shown here with this tan colored block. You've got this impacted groundwater flowing through that clay. And then you put a ZVI filled fracture into the clay. And this is one of the things that we do quite a bit of, ZVI injections. as Drew pointed out, 30-foot diameter, 15-foot radius is a good size to think about for this fracture. This is a horizontal fracture. We're looking at kind of a cross-section of the clay here. Now, what happens after you put that CVI fracture in the ground? Well, first of all, the fracture is oriented parallel to flow. That's an important concept to keep in mind. And it acts as a preferential flow path for the impacted groundwater. And over time, the longer that fracture sits there, you essentially get you distort the local groundwater flow such that you're getting more and more of that sort of treatment thickness. And as these lines start to converge toward the fracture, and now you're getting, sort of a capture zone, if you will, of the impacted groundwater. It's flowing through the fracture, and then you're getting that treated groundwater flowing out the other side. And there's one key component to this, which is you need to have a different K and a different hydraulic conductivity, a higher hydraulic conductivity in that fracture than in the surrounding formation. We like to see 10 or 100 times in terms of that delta, that difference in the Ks. And that gives you that ability to create sort of really, these tall vertical capture zones using a single fracture. Now you start to put multiple fractures together, stack those with depth, and you can imagine treating many tens of feet of groundwater with a system of those fractures. So that's refractive capture. Now let's look at that same fracture, and we're going to talk about diffusion. Now, earlier, Drew talked about diffusion from the fracture outward. Now we're going to sort of reverse that concept. So now we got our ZVI filled fracture again shown here, and we've got some TC adsorbed to the soil around it, shown by these nice TCE molecules. And what you can see here is we've got higher concentration of the TCE as we get away from the fracture, lower concentration as we approach the fracture. And that's what's going to show with this gradient, these arrows. And that concentration gradient that is established by basically driving the concentration at the fracture to zero drives the TCE diffusion toward the ZVI. So you've established that steep concentration gradient between the top part of this soil cross-section, if you will, and the ZVI fracture. And that is another component of treating these low permeability sites with fractures and with ZVI in particular. So those are the two kind of pieces to keep in mind as we're thinking about these case studies moving forward. And so that's going to bring us to our first Q&A session. And before we jump into that, I just want to say a couple of things really quickly about the slide that you see here. So here's another excavated trench sidewall photo of a fracture. You can see the fracture here, again, is a dominantly horizontal attitude. There's a quarter here for scale. And the other thing I want to point out here is that this fracture is cutting across the relic fabric of the formation. And that's a really important piece of information to keep in mind as you're thinking about using fractures to treat sites. This is a geotechnical process that is used to emplace this amendment. And unlike Darcy flow, which is often used for injecting amendments in the ground, we are not limited by following the fabric of the formation. And so that has distinct advantages in some of these low permeability materials. And with that, I will pass it over to our moderators for the first Q&A.
All right, excellent. So I'm going to encourage the audience, if they haven't opened the Q&A panel, go ahead and click the Q&A button at the bottom of your screen to pop it open now. And we have a nice collection of questions, and I can already tell which ones you all would like to start with. So I'm gonna read the most popular question and just give the audience here a moment here. As you're scrolling through questions, you should see a thumbs up icon that you can click if you agree with that question or you'd like me to read that. So I don't know if I can take them all, but I'll certainly start with some of the most popular ones today. So without a doubt, the most overwhelming question from the audience is looking at a risk that fracturing will release more of the contamination. I think they're just trying to balance if it, you know, frees flow up and it does this amazing stuff, how do you not let the contaminants move when you frack?
Yeah, I'll take that one, Drew. Actually, fracturing has a lot of advantages for not moving contamination around. And one of the key pieces for why that is volume. We're injecting these very high concentration, thick viscous slurries. A ZVI slurry might contain 25 pounds per gallon of microscale ZVI. Injecting a much smaller volume, as you can imagine, reduces the risk that you're going to start pushing contamination around. And that is, I think, the biggest factor to consider when you're considering whether you're going to move contamination around or not. Now, we may get access to contaminants that were not accessed before under the, you know, Darcy flow regime that was dictating, you know, how contaminants were moving in the formation. And we've seen that at sites. But we are also putting remediation amendment right into contact with those new pathways. And yeah, as a result, kind of directly cutting them off while at the same time accessing them. So that, yeah, those, I think those two pieces are the most important to keep in mind when you're thinking about whether we'll move contamination around.
Okay. We did have a couple of questions, more of the specific mechanics of fracturing. So a number of the attendees are wondering, how do you determine the diameter of the fracture zone after you inject?
Chapman, I'll answer that one and you can fill in if you'd like.
Sure. Yeah.
The diameter of the fracture is largely controlled by the volume. It's really two things. One is the volume of slurry that's being injected. And it's easy to imagine that as you inject more slurry, that the fracture footprint gets larger and larger. The other important criteria here is the attitude of the fracture. And that's why it's important that these fractures be as horizontal as possible, because that allows the fracture to grow to its greatest extent away from the injection location. And I skipped over a couple of process steps that help us be able to do that. But those are the two keys, is volume and the horizontal attitude of these fractures that we're creating. Now, there was another point I was going to make there.
Well, I can add two.
Why don't you bail
I'll add
me
two
out,
more.
Chapman.
Yeah, I'll add two more points to that. One is depth. Depth is an important consideration to how big these fractures can be. As you can imagine, the shallower the fractures are, the more likely that they're going to make their way to the surface, which we like to avoid and are very good at avoiding. So if you were to create a fracture at 5 feet below ground surface versus a fracture at 25 feet below ground surface, that 25 foot fracture could be larger and still remain flat. The other piece that I'll mention is a lot of direct push contractors will go out to a site. If they're injecting a slurry, they'll just keep injecting and keep injecting and keep injecting. And all of a sudden, you'll see that material come to the surface. Well, that is uncontrolled fracturing. And FRX's experience at creating fractures at all of the different sites on that map that Drew showed earlier has really put us in a position to understand the volume limitations of these fractures at a given depth for a given amendment. And as such, we can create, you know, we know what the formation will take. We know what's achievable at a site and how to keep that amendment in the ground, basically.
Can you talk a little bit about the pressures that you're using for injection or creating the fractures?
Sure. You want to take that one, Drew?
Yeah. We have to differentiate between overburden and bedrock. And for injection and overburden to create a fracture, a common pressure is on the order of 100 PSI to inject this very thick viscous slurry. Now, I mentioned I skipped a couple of steps in the process description, and it's through some of those processes that we can, that allows us to create fractures at that, what I consider to be a low pressure, because if you were to try to inject a slurry just by exposing some of the formation to a screen, for example, at the bottom of a probe rod, it would require much, much greater pressure. But using our methods for overburden, 100 PSI to inject that slurry is a reasonable and representative number. Now, for bedrock, as you can imagine, pressures can be higher. They're typically on the order of, you know, a few hundred PSI. The highest that we've seen have been at a couple of sites in the Carolinas, so in crystalline bedrock, where we've needed, you know, over 1,000 PSI to create fractures in the bedrock. So, but around 100 PSI for overburden, you know, 500 plus for bedrock.
Okay. I'm going to take one more question because it has a lot of people asking me to ask it, but you tell me if we have time to get into this, just making a note that it is about 4:11 p.m. Eastern. They're asking for your thoughts or experience when you're fracking at a site with DNAPL.
Chapman, you want to take that one?
Yeah, I'll take that one.
Done a good bit of it.
Yeah, we've used fracturing at quite a lot of sites with DNAPL.
We'll see a case study.
And we will, and incidentally, that was not our question, but it very conveniently fits into the case study that I'm going to be talking about later, where we did use ZVI to treat a very high concentration source area. I can't say whether or not it has DNAPL present. I'm not allowed to say that, but there's very high contamination at that site. And so I will talk about that a bit, but I will say this kind of gets back to one of the earlier statements about, about how much material we're injecting. And again, opening up those pathways to treatment, but minimizing the injection volume, because we don't want to be pushing DNAPL around in a source area. We don't want to be pushing that outside of the target treatment zone. We don't want to be pushing that into down gradient groundwater. And the case study that I'll be talking about managed to avoid those kind of key problems. So.
Okay, well, I think we'll close the question break here. Again, just quick time check. I have 4:13 p.m. Eastern. And I just want to thank the audience. You did a fabulous job crowdsourcing those questions. Questions will still stay in the queue. You can keep voting on them, but this is the way we'll be running the session. Send your questions in and vote on others. And that's how we'll lead in for our Q&A break. So I'll turn it back to you, gentlemen, to carry on with the talk.
All right. Thank you, Jean. So let's start talking about some sites. And make sure I am in control here and advancing slides. There we go. We're going to start this next section with another poll question. So which of the following treatment technologies have you utilized in the last 5 years? And again, you can select all that apply.
All right. So again, I'm looking to have you check off all the answers, and I'm starting to see those responses coming in. About a third of you have voted. This will help our instructors sort of tailor the conversation based off of your experiences here. And as I'm seeing about half of you have voted, I know we'll get up to 60%. This is my way of buying time and encouraging those of you who have not voted to go ahead and get your answers in.
Remember, there's no
judgment here, no wrong answer.
That's right.
All right. So I'm going to go ahead and close our poll down here. And let's take a look at those results. And so from what I can see, the top response here was ISCO with about 3/4 of the audience having used that in the last 5 years, but about almost as much have used enhanced bioremediation. About 2/3 used SVE with MPE, and then about half of them or so used ISCR and then air sparging or biosparging.
Well, Gene, I knew it was going to be chemical oxidation, which is why the next slide is going to start with chemical oxidation. So thank you, everyone, for answering. We encourage you to keep that up. And I am going to forward to here to a map showing the sites where FRX has created fractures to support chemical oxidation projects. That's 95 projects, over 2,000 projects, or rather fractures created. And if you see in the lower left-hand corner, we're keeping this treatment concepts image here. And the reason I'm doing it here for ISCO is that for ISCO, we can create sand-filled fractures for injection of liquid oxidant plus or minus activator reagents. Or as we saw on the slides, under concepts of chemical diffusion, we can emplace these materials, we can inject these slurries with oxidants as the primary solid, again, plus or minus an activator. So first, let's look at a case study from an industrial site in Colorado that illustrates the use of fractures for flow enhancement to treat a source area using chemical oxidants. And I want to acknowledge our client, Geosyntec, and Ted Kester and Emily Stockwell out of Colorado, and Gary Stanley out of Illinois. Really appreciate their support on this project and allowing us to share the information with you all. A little bit of background, the source is a vapor degreaser, and there were chloroethanes and chloroethenes in this source area. And of course, with 111 TCA, you're going to have 1,4-dioxane, which was identified during subsequent investigations. The geology here are variably weathered alluvial deposits. So it's sort of variably indurated claystone and siltstone, variably weathered rather. So the claystone and siltstone weather to a variably silty clay, the sandstone to a clay sand. So sort of a mixture of hardness and permeability, challenging setting for injections. And then groundwater flow primarily occurred through these high K units that created a large plume extending off site. And what you see here is a plan view of the site with a few features that I'll point out. One is that we've got this former degreaser here and a plume extending off site, a couple of separate plumes over to the southeast. But there's been remediation employed at the site since 2000, and it began with and continues to this day with hydraulic control along that northern property boundary. So that's been effective at bringing back some, or at least controlling offsite migration. There was also some enhanced bioremediation offsite, and then that's also along this eastern property boundary what was done. FRX participated in a fracturing exercise that for enhanced bio, so emulsified oil and some other things were injected into fracture-enhanced wells along that eastern property boundary to control some offsite migration. What the subject of this case study is source treatment. And so those green points that you see along the western edge of the building are injection wells. So this source area, the target zone was 25 to 38 feet beneath the building. And it couldn't be accessed via vertical injection wells. So we created fractures from angled wells, and they were quite steeply angled. They were 60 degrees from vertical and drilled to 85 feet TD, or about 43 feet BGS. And in each of those wells, we created 5 sand-filled fractures for a total of 15 fractures. And here's a photograph of my colleagues, one operating. Chapman, will you enable the laser pointer, please? One of them operating, this is Dean operating our injection unit here, and our colleague Jesse overseeing the operation. Here in the foreground, you see one of these angled wells, you see other two in the background. And going down this closest well is frac pipe, which we is part of our equipment. tied into an injection hose going back to our injection rig. So we're actively injecting a sand-laden slurry to create a sand-filled fracture at depth. So this was a unique approach in that it was a permanganate persulfate liquid mixture to treat both the chlorinated solvents, which included TCA, chloroethenes, as well as 1,4-dioxane. And so this is quite innovative. And that formulation and the dosing were determined by some treatability testing. And you see here some of the dosing and delivery metrics. So there's sodium persulfate, there's sodium permanganate, and the total solution that was injected is about 11,000 gallons at about 4 to 6 GPM typically and 5 to 15 PSI. And if that injection had been attempted without creating fractures first, the flow rates would have been much less and the pressure would have been much higher and the distribution would have been much poorer. So that was the scope of the work. And just a few results here, going from kind of left to right across the chart, you've got the injection well shown and labeled there. And MW36 is sort of closest to the wells, but a little bit side gradient. But you saw a large decrease, 77% decrease between the baseline in 2016 and the December 2018 sampling event for the total VOCs. Not much of a decrease in 1,4-dioxane, but we do see decreases in 1,4-dioxane for these other wells, including going from left to right, MW38, where there was a significant decrease in total VOCs, as well as a big decrease in 1,4-dioxane. And you see the same thing at MW35, which is a little more hydraulically or hydrologically connected to the treatment, at least at the December 2018 monitoring point, which is the most recent data available. There will be data available as early as later this summer, but this is what's publicly available now. So that's an example of chemical oxidants being used via fracturing and a flow enhancement approach to treatment. Also want to talk a bit about potassium persulfate, because again, increasingly it's being used as a propant and as a treatment chemistry. I showed this fracture already. What I want to show here is a video of slurry that's composed of potassium persulfate and hydrated lime. And that hydrated lime obviously is the activator, but you see just how thick and viscous this material is. This is a slurry that contains up to 70% solids by weight. So a very thick, viscous slurry that we're injecting to create fractures at a very shallow depth. These fractures were created at 4 and about 7.5 feet BGS in clay using this slurry. And we only had daylighting on 3 of 78 fractures for this site. So very thick, viscous slurry is one of the keys to creating good horizontal fractures. Each of those fractures in what I just referenced had 500 pounds of KP and hydrated lime. Click, click, click. All right, so I want to talk a little bit about our experience using potassium persulfate. There's been 5 projects in 4 states. The first in Colorado, that was the first application of potassium persulfate in North America. And we injected at about 25 to 28 feet BGS for treatment of PHCs as petroleum hydrocarbons. That was back in July 2018. And the application rate was 750 pounds of solids per fracture. That was potassium persulfate plus some proprietary activators. We did a 2-phase project for naphthalene and some chlorinated solvents in 2017 and then in 2019 that involved almost 40,000 pounds of KP plus activators in 71 fractures that were targeting a zone between 15 and 25 feet BGS. And you see the loading rate there of 440 to 660 pounds per fracture. Did a full-scale application of KP, just KP, no activator, in 2019 in Florida, involving 234 fractures between 30 and 50 feet PGS. And each of those fractures had between 850 and 1200 pounds of potassium persulfate per fracture. And then we did a full scale application just last summer, this time last year, in central Alabama, where we delivered 20,000 pounds of KP plus activator, hydrated lime activator. That was the video I showed, a slurry from that site, 500 pounds per fracture, injecting at very shallow depths. So that's our current portfolio of KP or potassium persulfate sites, and that's becoming an increasing part of what we do. All right. I believe there I'm going to pass things over. We're going to switch topics, talk about chemical reduction, and Chapman is going to take the reins. Chapman?
Thanks, Drew. So we talked about ISCO, and now we're going to talk about ISCR. So we see all our ZBI injection, primarily ZBI injection projects here in the United States, 24 projects and more than 1,800 fracs, just to give you a sense of the amount of material we put in the ground for this approach. And as with Drew, I'm going to sort of bring you in to a case study to talk about ZBI. I mentioned this case study earlier, so let's get into the details. Our site is in New England. You can see on the map here, it's up here in the Northeast, which is where I sit. I'm up in Boston. Here's our rig. Here's some high-pressure jets firing above ground surface. Exciting. And here's a nice, thick, viscous ZBI slurry. Ready to go in the ground to give you a sense of what this operation looks like. So before we get into the details, again, I want to acknowledge our clients for this work. I actually led the design for this project when I was at Geosyntec before I joined FRX, and worked with these great people based in and around Massachusetts, Chris Martin and Rhiannon Scott and Chris Green at Geosyntec. So I want to thank them for letting us talk about this case study, and we'll get into it with that. So I just want to give you a kind of a big picture overview of what we're of the site here. So you can see at the end of these railroad tracks, there's a higher concentration zone. We call this the railroad loading area. Those are historical releases that happened there. And we've got our groundwater flow kind of moving over this way. There's a river right here, which you'll see on the next slide. And then the plume is shown here outlined with this sort of yellow shape. And that's kind of the approximate extent of what we're trying to clean up with the ZVI injection. So it's a former manufacturing facility. And the other thing I want to point out here is that chloropicrin is the primary contaminant of concern. So this is a chlorinated solvent. It's a strawberry fumigant, and it is also was used for a brief period as a tear gas. So very low odor threshold, will make you cry if it gets in contact with the air. And as a result of that, the state regulators were very much not interested in that soil being excavated. And that really limited our options for treatment in this area. Here's an aerial photo showing the site. You can see it's hard to get a sense for that last photo, but there's a lot of topography drops off, ground surface elevation drops off very dramatically as you get down toward this quite broad river. Groundwater flow is kind of headed down the hill. And again, here's our treatment area. Complex geology at this site. It's a glacial geologic setting. We've got a layer of fill. We've got silt and clay below the fill. There's perched water in the silt and clay. Some higher concentrations tied up in that lower permeability unit. Then we have a nice coarse sand grading down to a gravel, sand and gravel. To the top of a till. And again, at this interface between the sand, between that gravel and the top of the till And into the till, we've got another zone of high concentrations. Groundwater is moving from right to left. So a bunch of different treatment zones, tricky geology. How do we address this? So it's a two-phase design for the treatment of this. So let's talk about phase one first. So in the shallow zone, and I'm not going to talk about this a whole lot. I'll give you kind of some broad results at the end. But in the shallow, in that perched water zone, we did sand-filled fractures tied into SVE wells to basically enhance traditional SVE methods to remove mass from that silt and clay. We performed a pilot test using traditional SVE wells, so no fractures, and we're able to get basically zero flow out after we installed the fractures and put wells into contact. We were able to get, you know, 1 to 10 SCFM of flow from each of those shallow wells. So really worked quite well to get air moving through that silt and clay zone. Now down deeper, and this is really the focus of the presentation, we've got ZBI injections in the saturated zone. That's in in phase one, those injections took place in kind of the core of the treatment area in that railroad loading area. We're injecting ZVI in a thick guar gel slurry. And we also bio-augmented with KB1 plus. And that was based on the results from some bench tests that showed the addition of KB1 plus really helped to speed treatment along. So for phase one here, our ZVI injections, we're looking at a 12-foot design ROI, which is a conservative ROI for us, but kind of met the client's needs and the project team needs. We're treating a 6-foot treatment thickness, so not a real thick zone at that gravel until interface. For phase one, we've got a 2,800 square foot treatment area, 7 injection locations, and 37,000 pounds of microscale ZBI injection injected into 24 fracs. So to get a sense for how the treatment is working, we're showing both phase one and phase two here, injections, so you can just sort of imagine for a second these wells overlaid onto this slide. So these 4 red locations are the primary monitoring points that I'm going to be showing you some data from. There are additional wells that are just up gradient that really don't have much concentration in them at all at this point. And so we're not going to look at those, but these are the 3 hottest wells in the treatment area and moving down gradient. So here are the data from those 3 wells. So phase one treatment here is shown in green. Initial concentration at this well in blue here is close to 1 million micrograms per liter. The solubility of chloropicrin, the aqueous solubility of chloropicrin, is about 2 million micrograms per liter. So just keep that in mind. Also quite high concentrations at these other 2 wells as well. So after phase one treatment, really only about a year after injections, we saw a 96% treatment at these 3 wells. Those results were favorable enough that our client wanted to move forward with phase two, which we did. So let's talk about phase two design. Getting a little more complicated here. We expand the treatment zone in that shallow, again, using the fracture-enhanced SVE. In the deep zone, the deep vadose zone, as we call it, we use traditional SVE wells here to treat some lower impacts, but still impacts in the sand above the gravel. And then expanded the injections within that railroad loading area to include a bigger portion of the source. And then along with that, we inject a transect of ZVI along the downgradient edge, just downgradient of that river loading area to sort of cut off the migration of chloropicrin toward the river. So now we can see our phase one and phase two scopes sort of overlaying on the same photo here, on the same figure. The gray is phase one, the blue is phase two. Phase two expands that full scale treatment zone to 9,500 square feet. And again, a 6 foot thickness. Downgradient transective treatment locations, where let's call that an injected PRB, has a 12 foot treatment thickness. Again, all these are 12 foot radius of influence for the design. The total for phase two is 27 injection locations and 76 fractures and 163,000 pounds of microscale ZBI. So that brings us to post phase two treatment. So here's our phase one treatment again. You may note that we have switched to a log scale, and you will see why in just a moment. Quite a lot of variability in the results post phase two treatment, particularly with this well in brown. We'll get back to that one in a second, but let's talk about the well in green and blue. So slow and steady decreases in concentration at these two wells here, to the point where 3 years post injection, we're seeing about 99.9% treatment at both of these locations. It actually works out to exactly that number for both wells. Gotta love it when the results work out like that. However, this well, you can see, has had some variability post injection. The latest two data points here, luckily, are down to 71% treatment. But I will talk a little bit about where this well is located and give you some context on what these results mean. So that well is located right here. We know that there's a high soil concentration located in the core of this treatment area, right? Kind of around where my cursor is shown, where my laser pointer is shown. It's not a surprise to us that the concentrations at this well are quite high. And as we've seen, those concentrations have bounced around quite a bit since we injected the ZBI. However, overall, we're on a decreasing trend and down to 71% of where we started. And this well is surrounded by ZBI. And as a result, we know that, you know, we're going to get a good amount of longevity out of that treatment. And we expect those concentrations to continue to go down over time. Additionally, this well, which is one of the other wells that I showed you on that last chart, both of these wells, my understanding, I don't have these data yet to share with you, but my understanding is that these two wells in the latest round have continued to decrease and are approaching single digit microgram per liter concentration. So I hope to be able to share those data with you soon, but overall, you know, great news headed down gradient and out of the treatment area. So brings me to my conclusions for the case study. So phase one treatment was very successful, and it led us to phase two. The fracture enhanced SVE wells allowed us to really remove quite a lot of air from that shallow clay interval. And overall, you can see a picture here on the left-hand side of the SVE system, the inside of the SVE system. Overall, they've removed 340 kilograms of chloropicrin to date, and are continuing to get mass removal from those wells. And as I pointed out before, we're having a lot of success treating that high concentration source zone and cutting off contamination to the down gradient plume. And that brings us to our third poll question, which we'll pass it back to Jean to run.
All right, so we've got our third and final question up on the screen, and just asking about your experience about the typical unit cost. And we're talking about dollars per cubic yard for treatment of low permeability sites. And we do have some international attendees, so I'm just going to launch in here and say, Chapman, I think we're talking about U.S. dollars per cubic yard.
Yeah, that's response. Right. U.S. dollars, please. All right. Take your best guess if you're from outside the U.S.
All right. And again, I'll just give you a few more seconds to vote. There's no penalty for putting something in if it doesn't turn out to be accurate. You know, this is just here to get a sense of what your experiences are. And so I'm waiting. I'm seeing about 40% of you, maybe a few more. We were averaging about 60% of you, and I know you all are still there. Okay. All right. So I'm going to go ahead. And if you haven't actually, if you don't have access to that information, perhaps you've never been involved in the costing for one of these projects, that's okay. So I'll go ahead and end the poll here since it looks like the answers have a bit leveled out. And let's talk about what the results were. So it looks like about 40% of the audience picked the third option, about $100 to $150 per cubic yard, with about a third saying more than $150 per cubic yard.
All right. Well, good. This will take us into the section on reagent dosing, and then we will talk about costs. But let's skip ahead to it. And what I want to talk about quickly here is reagent dosing and field productivity. On the left, heading each row is the dosing range, the pounds per fracture, the typical pounds per fracture, and then an average pounds per day for potassium permanganate projects, persulfate projects, and zero-valent iron. And for permanganate, dose range typically ranges in, between 10 and 15 pounds of potassium persulfate permanganate, excuse me, per cubic yard of treatment zone. And to get that, we're typically 1,000 to 1,500 pounds of permanganate per fracture. And as you can see in that pounds per day portion of the table, we, since 2002, have been improving our efficiency to allow us to increase our productivity in terms of pounds delivered to the subsurface each day. So those are pounds per day average for three projects for potassium permanganate. For potassium persulfate and activators, we have a smaller sample size, but we're around 6 to 9 pounds of persulfate plus activators per cubic yard. And part of the reason that's lower, a little bit lower than potassium permanganate, is because of the density, the relative density of these materials, and especially the activators. Hydrated lime, for example, has a fairly low specific gravity and bulk density. 500 to 1,000 pounds per fracture, though we expect to be able to increase that. You know, you saw the example from Florida, we were up to 1,200 or 1,250 pounds. And then for our recent projects, we've been injecting 5,000 to 5,500 pounds per day of persulfate and activator. The dosing range for zero-valent iron, I'll change the metric a little bit because most of us are used to thinking of that dosing in terms of weight percent of dry soil in the target treatment zone, and you see the range there. We can get in, because of its high specific gravity, we can get a lot of ZVI into a single fracture. Commonly 1,500, 2,500, 3,000 pounds. We've got an upcoming project that's going to be 4,400 pounds per fracture. And per day, we can inject at least 12,000 pounds of ZVI per day and up to about 16,000 pounds, as we did on the site that Chapman highlighted. So on to costs. I'm going to cover the chemical oxidation costs, and then I'll hand things over to Chapman to talk about a little bit bigger data set. But these are three sites, Alabama, New Mexico, and Pennsylvania. The Alabama site was potassium persulfate and hydrated lime. You saw the slurry video. We injected about 19,000 pounds, 20,000 pounds of amendment mass into 2,300 cubic yards. And cost for that was about $50 per cubic yard. And that includes direct push drilling, the reagents, and FRX injection services. And treatment costs refer to that, to those three, for all of these that we're presenting. The New Mexico site was also persulfate, in that it was mostly potassium, a little bit of sodium, and a little bit of iron EETA as a catalyst. That was $76 per cubic yard for, again, drilling, reagent, and FRX injection services. And in Pennsylvania, potassium permanganate, we aggressively hit a relatively small treatment area with a lot of permanganate to treat a high concentration source area. So costs are higher. It was not direct push. It was a different drilling method. So costs there are $140 per cubic yard. So it's falling in the range of where you folks responded. And with that, I'll hand it over to Chapman to talk about chemical reduction costs.
Thanks, Drew. We're in the home stretch here, guys.
Yeah, almost up.
Thanks for everyone for sticking on the sticking with us throughout this and allowing us to cover such great material. So here's a big old table. I'm not going to read every line to you because I don't want to put everyone to sleep, but I will bring your attention to a couple of items, which these are 8 projects that were shown here. They include pilot and full scale. There's a PRB in here. So a wide range of projects, a wide range of sizes. So this pilot project is just 444 cubic yards. This big full scale treatment in North Carolina is 11,000 cubic yards. And the ZVI mass ranges from 6,000 to 182,000 pounds of microscale ZVI. And as such, there's a wide range of treatment unit costs. And I'll show you a chart here in just a second to kind of give you a chance to visualize this a little better. But, you know, ranging and really covering that full range of responses from folks on that last poll question, ranging from $33 per cubic yard on up to more than $200 per cubic yard. And that brings us to our next slide, which is basically a plot of the treatment unit cost here along the x-axis and the ZVI mass loading along the y-axis. So Drew mentioned that range earlier. And the way I'd like to sort of encourage you to think about this chart is if you have a strong concentration, high concentration Dean Apple source zone that you're trying to treat, that might push you up into this, you know, $175 to $250 per cubic yard range. So you're going to need a lot of ZVI, close spacing of injection points, both with laterally and with depth to get that to reach this kind of mass loading. There aren't many contractors out there that can achieve a 2.5-3% ZVI mass loading by dry weight of soil. But we have done it on many projects. In the center here, you can think about this as a moderate source treatment or a PRB cost, kind of in this, you know, center box here, $100 to $150 per cubic yard. And then down kind of at the low end here, thinking about more dilute plume treatment, you know, very low concentration source treatment down here in the, you know, $25 to $75 per cubic yard. Just giving you a way to sort of think about how these costs fit into the implementation of the ZVI injection technology at a range of different sites. And with that, that will bring us to our final slide before we go into our last Q&A. Over here on the right-hand side, you can see some of the things that we might ask you if you can, if you give us a ring or send us an email looking to see if we can, if fracturing is right for your site. We want to know what kind of drilling technique works at the site. What's your target treatment zone and how deep is it? And what remedial approach are you looking at and where is the site located? Here are our contact information, which you can get from downloading the slides as well. And with that, we will bring up, that will bring us into the last Q&A. And I'll pass it back to our moderators. Thanks, guys.
Okay. All right. Thank you, gentlemen. So it does look as though we have some time for additional Q&A. So I will remind the audience, if you have not opened up that Q&A window, now is a great time to do so and start scrolling through questions that have come in from other students in the class so that we can get a good head count on who's most interested in which questions. Remember to click that thumbs up button and we'll be able to see which questions are the most interesting to all of you. Okay, so let me start at the top of the list here. And this one is about monitoring. And so a lot of people are interested, can a site manager monitor the fracture formation in the field without cutting a trench?
The short answer is kinda, and I'll elaborate. We've learned the most about fracture form from excavations, but that is not the only way to understand fracture form. And there are simple ways to do it, such as groundwater monitoring in nearby wells. There are parameters, field parameters, such as DO, specific conductance, ORP, sometimes pH, but especially conductance. Can really pop and is very useful. So there's some cheap, monitoring methods, field methods that allow you to collect a lot of data in a short period of time to understand distribution of fractures in the field. There is also coring that can be done after taking or making fractures. And that can be helpful in looking for fractures and understanding distribution of fractures. You just have to take a lot of samples. You have to take a lot of cores to be able to get a good representative picture of what the fractures look like in the treatment zone. And then the last one really is ground surface deformation. So every time you create a fracture, that 1 centimeter of uplift that occurs above the fracture, because that's what you're doing. You're just lifting the overburden above that fracture by on the order of a centimeter. That will eventually reach the surface. Now, it's muted by all the overburden above it, but what you have at the surface when you create a fracture is a very small magnitude dome-like feature that can either be measured with a total station and survey stakes if the fractures are shallow enough, or by more sensitive equipment, tilt meters. And both of those methods have their limitations, but can be instructive. So I guess one way to wrap this up is by saying you can't map fractures using ground surface deformation, but it can be instructive in giving you an idea of the distribution of fractures at depth.
You can think about it like lines of evidence, right? You can have lines of evidence resulting from surface deformation, as Drew pointed out, groundwater monitoring, some borings, and you can kind of use all of those to put together a pretty comprehensive picture of what these fractures look like in the subsurface. But you can't really fully map them unless you dig them up, and that's just the way it is.
Okay. Okay, we had a number of people who were interested, and I think you talked a bit about this, but they're curious about fracking different geologic layers differently. So I'm thinking sites are not as simple as some of the, you know, conceptual pictures may have shown. So we may have different layers, and can you frack the different layers at a site? And are there some major cost implications if you're fracking the sand one way and bedrock a different way?
Yeah, I can take that one, Drew. Yeah. I mean, the case study that I described is a great example. You saw the variation in the geology with depth. We had, you know, we had that silt and clay shallow. We had gravel sitting above the till. And then we had that tight glacial clay till. We used the same injection method for all of those layers, and were able to successfully create fractures at all those depths across all the different geologic settings. And there was quite a lot of scrutiny on that site, actually, on us meeting our design ROI for the size of the fractures that we created. And using a variety of different methods, including surface uplift, pressure log analysis, we were able to demonstrate that we met the design ROI. And showed greater than 12-foot radius for every fracture that we measured, which was, I think, 50% of the fractures that we created, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, that's right. Half that we collected those data on half the fractures.
Okay. Our next question, that's got a couple of votes here. One of the attendees noted, I'm curious about the best method of site characterization to design performance. And they give an example. Would a CPT type of investigation on a tighter discretization be more beneficial than conventional drilling with index property testing? They also go on to ask, would this be more of a design phase consideration that got handled by a remedial contractor rather than by a consultant?
I'll speak to that a little bit, and Chapman, fill in the gaps. FRX doesn't need unusual, I'll put it, data to create a good design for fracturing. A good site characterization of your target treatment zone is sufficient for us to prepare a good design. And so that's just the hydrogeological data, the geology, the treatment approach, the geochemistry. Things that you ordinarily are collecting are good and sufficient for us to create a good design. Mm-hmm. there are no, our models aren't, detailed enough to be able to use certain geotechnical properties, for example, deformation properties of different formations. So none of those geotechnical parameters are going to plug into our models, and we haven't found that we've needed those. So a good characterization using CPT, as the questioner asked, or direct push, or any drilling method, you all define the box and give us a good picture of what's going on inside that box, and that's good information to create a high quality design.
Yeah, I think good geologic boring logs, and I mean, if you could do a MIP investigation, if it's a coordinated solvent site, and really map where the distribution of contaminants are and how those interact with the kind of known geologic layers at the site, then of course, yes, that will help us design a more effective remedy by targeting those high concentration zones. That's not always in the budget for every site, but when it is, it does help us kind of on the remediation design side, which FRX is happy to help you with.
Excellent. All right, let's see if we can take just a few more questions here before we go through some final reminders. A number of people were curious about the type of ZVI you're using. Someone asked, are you using commodity ZVI? They also ask, have you experimented with sulfidated micro ZVI? And they note that the kinetics for PCE and TCE are faster than just bare ZVI. And they also say the electron transfer efficiency is much higher due to the sulfidation.
Yeah, I can cover that one. We have injected pretty much every kind of ZVI that there is on the market, including Rio Tinto, Connolly, Hepier, and more recently we've injected quite a lot of Hoganis ZVI, okay. which we are liking a lot these days. So, you know, commodity, well, I don't know, in my mind, all ZVI is a commodity. Yes, we've injected pretty much all different types of ZVI. Sometimes folks come to us and say, hey, what would you recommend? Other times they say, hey, we did this bench test and this is what we want you to use. And that's fine. We can deal with any material, really. Sulfidated, I don't think we've injected any sulfidated ZVI as of yet. I do know from some conversations with folks who are running a bench test on a project that we're working on that in terms of compatibility with our injection process, don't expect any problems at all with the guar gel and working with sulfidated ZVI. So if you want to pay the money to put sulfidated ZVI in the ground, which may make a lot of sense at some sites, as they pointed out, some contaminants react a lot better with the sulfidated ZVI.
Sorry, Chapman. There are two sites where we did inject sulfidated ZVI.
Oh, is that right? Okay.
Yeah, those were liquid. One was in California, the other in New Mexico, and those were liquid colloidal ZVI products.
Right.
And Chapman, you remember from the CIRM webinar that Paul Tratniak presented on, he talked about sulfidation, and one of our takeaways was that with smaller grain size, sulfidation becomes increasingly important. Most of what we inject is certainly a lot coarser than these colloidal ZVI materials that are,
correct,
you know, 2, 5, 10 microns. We're injecting, you know, 300, 200 kind of particle sizes in that range.
Yeah, cost is a real big issue, you know, as you start to get with the smaller and smaller ZVI. I mean, the material that we put in the ground on a regular basis is, you know, 50, 60 cents a pound. This is the micro scale ZVI. You can affect a lot of treatment for a very reasonable amount of money injecting that material in the ground. Sulfidated colloidal sized ZVI is quite expensive.
Okay. Well, gentlemen, I am sad to say we have come right up at our scheduled end time. And although there are some other fantastic questions in the queue, I just don't think we have enough time to get through it. But I will be sure to capture these questions and share them with the presenters team, and so that they at least have a sense of what some of your questions were. And maybe we need to do a part two for this webinar.
Sounds good to us.
All right.
See you more.
See you in September.
Exactly. So what I'm going to do is go ahead and turn on the screen sharing here, and I'm going to call up some quick final reminders that we have before we go ahead and close things out for the day. And I can see Josh is coming back on because Josh wanted to be sure to remind you all of our ongoing partnership. So let me go ahead and turn it to Josh quickly for a couple of reminders before I close things out.
Thank you very much, Gene. So I just want to remind you guys of our upcoming events in September for the webinar series, as well as our ongoing EPA SME construction management training. Feel free to check out that website down at the bottom of that slide for more information about upcoming events and stuff that we have going on. And just to give you a little teaser for what's to come, 10 years of optimization of the environmental restoration program at the DoD facility in North Carolina, September 15th, 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern. Check out that website down below for registration coming soon. And with that, I will pass it back to you.
All right. Thank you so much, Josh. So I'll go ahead and just remind everybody first by saying thank you. I just want to be sure to thank our presenters and our organizers and all of you who joined us for today's live broadcast. I certainly hope that you'll visit us at the Cleanup Information Network or CLUIN.org and that you're signed up for our monthly newsletter, which comes out on the first of each month, called Tech Direct. So if you're not subscribing to that and you want to attend more webinars like this and find out the latest and greatest when it comes up to hazardous waste site cleanup and characterization, I encourage you to subscribe to our free monthly newsletter. I will also remind everyone that the seminar homepage, which does not have a 7, it has an 8 on the end of it. So I apologize. We're just going to pretend like that 7 is an 8 at the end of it on this slide. So we shared the URL in the meeting chat earlier. I've put it in there now as well. So the seminar homepage, the same place you went to check in, the same place I highlighted at the start, that's where you can go to download the presentation materials. I saw a few of you asking for those. And our speakers also shared a number of other related resources and write-up articles. So we've already posted those on the resources tab for the seminar as well. So I encourage you to visit that seminar homepage to learn more about some of their projects, as well as to download the slides should you like them. And then of course, the number one question I get is if I can offer PDHs or CDUs for our webinars. And while I don't issue those particular credit hours, I can provide you with a participation certificate if you fill out the online feedback form. So it's one of the tabs on the seminar homepage. I also put a link to that form in the meeting chat. If you can take a moment and fill out that form and let us know what you thought of the session, and be sure to check the box at the bottom, which certifies you watched the entire thing, that as soon as you check that box and send your feedback in, you'll immediately get access to a certificate that looks something like this with all of the event details. Oftentimes our attendees are able to earn credit because they can download the slides, get speaker bios, the session descriptions from the homepage, and get a certificate based off of joining us today. If you happen to join with a group of people at your location, remember each person can fill out that feedback form on their own to get their own certificate, even if they didn't register individually. And then for those of you who happen to be watching the recorded version of today's webinar, you are going to look in the upper right. It's not happening live, but in the archive version, it'll be there. There will be a big button in the upper right that has a link to our feedback form so that you can fill it out after you've replayed the entire archive and still get your own seminar feedback participation form or certificate. Pardon me. It's been a long day, ladies and gentlemen. I apologize. So with that, I think that's the end of the reminders, other than to, again, let you know I'll send you an email as soon as the archive is